Good evening, everybody. My name is Steve Showalter. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April the 10th, 1980. I have a sponsor. He has a sponsor. I have several sponsees, and some of them have sponsees. And in a nutshell, that's how AA works. I just got through reading a book this week called Drunks, and it's about the history of alcoholism in America. And it's really interesting. I think the two things that have made Alcoholics Anonymous so successful, number one is all of our interaction is alcoholic to alcoholic. And the other thing is singleness of purpose. A lot of the groups, like the Oxford groups, Washingtonians, and some of the Rational Recovery and some of these things, these organizations failed because they were not a program of total abstinence, which we are. If that's a surprise to you, I'm sorry. But we do believe that we should abstain from all alcohol and mind we used to say alcohol and mind-altering chemicals, but I don't know if that's still acceptable today. But my story starts in Harrisonburg up in the Shenandoah Valley. You all probably know it as the home of James Madison University. When I was being raised up there during the 50s, it was a little town of 10,000 people with a small college, a woman's teacher college called Madison College. But it was a perfectly beautiful place to grow up. It was a small town. It was very easy to have a good upbringing in Harrisonburg, Virginia. My parents were Southern Baptists, so there was no drinking in my house. The drinking was completely foreign to me. And I was raised with a brother, and I heard a lady say one time downtown that she'd been overchurched. And every time they opened the door at the Harrisonburg Baptist Church, we were there. So maybe I was overchurched, but by the time I got to be 14 or 15 years old, I had lost my use for the Harrisonburg Baptist Church. Somewhere between, it started with sports and females, but at 17, after the end of my high school football season, a friend of ours invited us over to his house. We went down in the basement, and there was a refrigerator plumb full of Colt 45 malt liquor. Now keep in mind, I've never tasted anything alcoholic in my life. But so after two or three of those, I was completely drunk. And we were running around outside without our shirts on. You know, it's November. This is just crazy. My father had been very active in not only the church functions, but the Boy Scouts. And all of my friends knew my dad. And so they decided I was too drunk to drive home, so they were going to take me home. And when he got me home, they led me up to the front door and just sort of leaned me against the door, rang the doorbell, and ran behind the bushes. And when Dad opened the door, I literally fell in on the floor. And I was too heavy for him to get me to carry me, but he got me not to my bedroom, but to my brother's bedroom, and he dropped me into bed. And the next morning I woke up, I had the first of what would be many horrible headaches. And my parents finally heard me moving around, I guess. They both came in together. And man, if he'd pulled his belt off and just whipped the crap out of me, I'd been happier than what I got, which was the hangdog, I'm disappointed in you. That hurt a whole lot worse. But around noon, I managed to get out of bed and go make a sandwich. And at 2 o'clock that afternoon, I called my friend Beefy. His real name was Ronnie Smith, still friends today. But I called him up and he said, man, you really got drunk last night. And I said, yeah, and what I want to know is when can we get some more of that? And, you know, if I stop my story right there, that should tell you that I was an alcoholic. People talk all the time about crossing a line. I never crossed any line. I was standing on the alcoholic side of the line when I took that first trip. And you can run that experience through the next 13 years 1,000 times, and it's the same story. Once I started drinking, I couldn't stop, and eventually I would get drunk and pass out. It was actually merciful when I would pass out because I could get away from doing some of the stupid things that I used to do. But that's how it started. And that was my senior year in high school. So the next year, I trotted off to Williamsburg to start college. And it was like taking a preacher's son and turning him loose in a big city. You know, boy, when I got down there and had absolutely no parental supervision, you know, I could just drink until my money ran out. And there were drugs at William & Mary when I was there, and that's all I have to say about that. But I will tell you that when I left college, I never used a drug again. Drugs were not my drug of choice. Ethyl alcohol was. And the other thing was I got a job that, if there's ever been a job made for the budding young alcoholic, it's called the road salesman. You know, I had a car and an expense account. And, you know, I can't tell you how many expense accounts I turned in that had me and a couple customers, and we'd never been within the same county of each other. But that company was an alcohol-driven company, and nothing was ever said about it. They certainly enabled. And I'm not saying any of them were alcoholics, but they sure liked to drink a lot. My very first, what I would call really negative consequence, happened in 1975. I had closed a big sale down at the New Bernew Shipyard, was driving back up Jefferson Avenue and pulled into a little bar called the Bluebeards. And I went in there and I drank all night. I came out about 12:30 in the morning, got in the car, and the minute I turned the car on, the red lights came on behind me. Yes, I am so old. Of course, Leo, you know old. But I am old enough that when the police pulled me the first time, the lights were red, not blue. But he was just sitting there in the parking lot, just waiting for some drunk to come out and drive drunk. So he arrested me, took me down, and threw me in the drunk tank. And the next morning, I went before Judge Harvell. If you had lived over on the peninsula, everybody knew Judge Harvell as being the judge that was a friend of the drunk. And when I went before him in the morning, he said, we're starting a new program called ASAP over Thomas Nelson Community College. And if you'll go to that, I will reduce your DUI to improper driving. That's right, improper driving, which is nothing. It's a very low grade misdemeanor. So I was living in Richmond at the time, and I would work during the day, I would get in the car, and I'd drive down to Newport News, I'd go to TNCC, go to the class for 3 hours, and then I would stop at the 7-Eleven on Harpersville Road and get a six-pack. And needless to say, the six-pack was empty when I got home to Ashland. And I did that during the entire course, every single time. And, you know, that first course cost $1,000 and had to pay a lawyer and all this stuff. You know, for a young kid in 1975, that was a painful financial experience. But it apparently didn't sink in, because to his word, Judge Harvell, once I completed the course, he reduced it to improper driving, which you will see was very fortunate. Because approximately 4 years later, in 1979, we took a whole busload of customers up to the University of Virginia for a football game. And the football game was just an excuse. It was really about a day of some good hard drinking. So when we got back to Ashland, and I've been drinking all day. I was just out on my feet. But there was a barracks for the state police right up Route 1 on the way home. And I thought, well, if I take the back roads through the country and go home, I'll miss the state police barracks. So I'm weaving through these back roads, and this car comes around, and the lights, and we swerved, and anyway, neither one of us ran off the road, but I'm driving home, and when I pull into my driveway, this car pulls in right behind me, and I had a gravel driveway, and he slammed on his brakes, and the car slid, and both of us rolled out of the car, and I ran up to him, and he ran up to me, and I punched him, and the next thing I know, I'm on my stomach in handcuffs. He was an off-duty state trooper. So the second DUI was also had a felonious assault charge attached to it. And Trooper Ferris, you know, I don't blame him for being mad. You know, I was drunk and I almost ran he and his wife off the road. So I understand why he was mad. But he wanted me to do hard time. I mean, if it was up to Trooper Ferris, I'd still be in the hoosegow up there. But the judge let me off with 30 days on the weekends. So Friday afternoon, I'd go check over to Hanover Hilton, spend the weekend over there. And then they check me out Friday, and Sunday afternoon. And it was interesting that night, while I'm laying on my face in the driveway with the handcuffs on, my wife and my mother-in-law are both standing on the front porch. And both of them explained to me that they'd had enough. And that if I didn't quit drinking, that she was leaving. So, like on page 31, I took a pledge, you know, with a solemn oath that I was never going to drink again. And you know what? I didn't drink for 6 months. And to this day, over 40 years later, that is the worst 6 months of my life. If there's anything worse than not drinking all day long, I don't want any part of it. But at the end of that 6 months, I had to go to a sales meeting in Roanoke, and one of my old drinking buddies, Carl, came up from Raleigh. And we went out to dinner. While we were at a dinner, I was bragging about how I hadn't had anything to drink for 6 months. So to celebrate the occasion, he ordered us a bottle of wine. I mean, Carl and I were two-fisted scotch drinkers. You know, wine's not drinking. Well, apparently it was, because they had to carry me to my bed, and they got me in the room and threw me down on the bed. I'm sorry there are ladies here, but I was a notorious bedwetter. And so in the middle of the night, I wet the bed. I woke up and realized what had happened. I rolled off the bed onto the floor. And that was one of the first cases I knew God was looking after me, because I didn't land on my back. I landed on my stomach. Do you know how many alcoholics die suffocating in their own vomit? A lot. But I woke up the next morning, and I was crushed. I had given it my best shot. I'd done everything that they'd asked me to do, and there I was, drunk again. And, you know, these consequences, these things that happen to us, they're really bad, but I found that the first step experience, that admission that I was powerless over alcohol, was all here. It was all right in my head. I looked in that mirror in the bathroom. I could not be that guy anymore. And so I cleaned up, called my wife, asked her to find an AA meeting. It turned out there was one right there in Ashland that night. So I got in the car, drove back to Richmond. And I went to that first meeting, and it was on the second floor of the Baptist Church in Ashland. And as I was going up the steps, I remember hearing men laughing. And I couldn't comprehend that. There was nothing in my life that was laughable to me. But I got up there, and as I'm coming in the door, this guy walks over to me, and he is like a caricature of an alcoholic. His skin is red. His nose is a big bulb. I really thought he was about the ugliest man I'd ever seen in my life. But he comes up to me with this big, huge grin on his face and says, "Well, young man, you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous. We're glad to have you." Well, at the end of the meeting, actually they had a New England style meeting where they had a speaker for 15 or 20 minutes, then it went around the table. It just so happened that group, it wasn't a men's group, but there was 12 men. And when it got around to me, I said, "I'm Steve Showalter and I'm an alcoholic. And I've never gone back on that." I felt, you know, a lot of people come to AA meetings for a long time before they admit they're alcoholics. I admitted I was an alcoholic the first time, and I wasn't wrong. So his name was Ed Harford. He's gone to the big meeting in the sky now, but I'm convinced that Ed was an angel, because Ed took me around to meetings, took me to beginners meetings, he took me to speakers meeting. He was old school. He told me basically to keep my mouth shut until I had something to say. And so we went to a lot of beginners meetings. He even took me to an NA meeting. But I said, "Listen, NA is just not for me." I said, "I'm an alcoholic." And you know, it during that time, there were a lot of men like me that were just alcoholic. You know, since that time, you know, I've been through the 80s and 90s and the women and their Valium and all that kind of stuff and the street drugs, and it's almost impossible today to find a person that's not addicted to more than one thing. But I'm convinced that it's our singleness of purpose that makes us very effective in dealing with a new alcoholic. So that was how I got here. And now in a couple months I'll be here 42 years, which I know is still 20 short of yours. But you know, I came in here, I was 30 years old, but the guy inside was 16 or 17. My emotional, spiritual, whatever kind of growth was stunted from the time that I started drinking. And you know, the problem was I was married and had children and really needed to find a way to be an adult. And you all taught me how to grow up and how to be an adult. We get to grow up in public, and sometimes it's not a pretty picture. But the thing that I like is, in the first step, it's we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives were unmanageable. That is three references in the first step to we and to us. And if you go through all 12 steps, there's 37 references to we, our, us. So I'd been trying ever since 1975 to modify or change my drinking to something that would keep me out of trouble. And none of it would work. The only thing that worked was me giving up and me turning myself over to you. Now, when I walked in that room, I didn't trust you. I didn't trust anything. But those guys kept saying that if I would do those 12 steps, I would never have to drink again. And most alcoholics have trust issues, and we have trust issues because we're not trustworthy, you know? So you have to start building trust by being trustworthy. Also, I really was not interested in any sort of religious organization. And Ed told me, he said, "Just focus on us. Focus on the 12 of us. We're staying sober." And he had been the Tom Hearn of Richmond. Matter of fact, when I got here to Smithfield in 1999, Tom actually had met my sponsor, Ed Harford. And the two of them had been on committees and stuff together. But Ed had stayed sober for 10 years. Then he got the big head, went out and drank, came back. By 1980, when I came in, he'd been sober another 10 years, and he died 3 years later. But Ed preached to me all the time that the greatest enemy to sobriety was pride, and that the longer you stayed in it, the more likely it was that if you had a slip, you wouldn't make it back. So I clung to the group, because I did have the gift of desperation. I'd had enough. From the very beginning to now, I have been willing to do what you tell me I should do. And I've also been a student for life. I love learning things. I've got a group of people within our fellowship that we trade books around all the time. You know, they say Alcoholics Anonymous is spiritual kindergarten. And I do a lot of reading trying to get into first grade. I don't know if I've made it quite yet. But an interesting part of my recovery was in November, Ed called me up and said, "What are you doing next month?" And I said, "I don't know." And he said, "Well, we're going down to Hampton. We're going to go to a Matt Talbot retreat." So I picked him up and we went over to the Holy Family Retreat Center in Hampton, and I went to my first retreat. And Saturday night, when they were going to have an AA meeting, Ed said, "We have a really interesting speaker tonight." And I said, "Oh yeah, who's that?" He said, "You." That was when I learned that no matter what you said, people would still clap and come tell you how much they enjoyed your talk. You know, that is part of the love and the non-judgmental part of Alcoholics Anonymous that keeps me wanting to come back. Because no matter what I say or do, you'll just keep loving me. But what I learned, what else I learned going to these retreats, is that there were a lot of other men that were serious about their spirituality, and I began to work on spirituality. I began trying to make contact with a higher power. I still go to 2 retreats a year, and I go now because every retreat is just like every meeting. I get something out of it, and I keep broadening my base of friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I learn things about staying sober all of your life. Life is made up of rather lengthy cycles, 15, 20 year cycles. You know, you grow up, you leave home, you go to school or you don't go to school, you get married, you have children, they grow up, they leave. Next thing you know, you're getting to be old. My grandfather-in-law told me one time when he and I were sitting on the porch, I was 25 years old, and we were doing our best to kill a bottle of Dewar's Scotch. And Walter said, "Son," he said, "when you're 65 years old, you'll be walking down the street one day and you'll run smack dab into your immortality." And he said, "It will scare you to death." And 5 or 6 years ago, that happened to me. So I had to do some prayer and meditation to come to grips with my own mortality. You know, you young guys have no real concept of being at the end of your journey. But during all those years, I moved around all over the country. Everywhere I went, you were there. In 1995, my house caught fire and burned down, and the first people to my house were members of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of them had been awake. It's 3 o'clock in the morning, and he'd had insomnia and heard him call out my address, and he knew it was my house. And the next thing, about 10 minutes after the fire trucks all got there, here comes a carload of members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And later in the day, when they were trying to get us put up in a motel or something, a member of this fellowship absolutely insisted on my family of 5 and my dog and 2 cats moving into their house. And we lived with them for a month, you know, until, you know, we had 10 people and 4 animals in there. And I lived in there for 30 days until I was able to arrange for some place to stay. But you'll never convince me that waking up that night and looking out the window of my house and seeing those flames coming out of my garage was not an act of God. And, you know, I say today, I guess I'm known as somewhat of a debater or arguer. I'm certainly known as being extremely blunt. But I can tell you that on April the 10th, 1980, I looked in the mirror and I asked God to remove the compulsion to drink. And I've never had a compulsion to drink since then. And that is the only proof of a higher power that I need. Now, I make it a point to study other religions and stuff, and my sponsees are getting sick and tired of me talking about meditation and Buddhism and all this stuff. I'm surprised they haven't gone to find new sponsors. But what was funny, in 2016, up at our meeting at Ben's United Methodist Church, the minister used to always come in and just talk to us. And he was just a great guy. You know, he was one of these regular guys. He liked NASCAR racing and everything. And he would come in and shake hands, but when we got ready to start the meeting, he'd leave. And one Sunday, he goes and sits down. And so we start the meeting, and he raises his hand, and he says, "You know, I finally owned up to the fact that I'm one of you." And his name was O.H. Burton. He died a few years ago of throat cancer. But he told me one day, he said, "You have a good program," but he said, "I don't see any evidence that you're doing any of the meditation that's required in step 11. So I would go over to his office, and we would meditate in his office using the Psalms as a mantra. And I was still having trouble maintaining any sort of concentration. So he got me to sign up for a class. So I took a class. And over the period of time, I've cultivated a daily. I have two daily habits. One of them is going to an AA meeting, and the other one is meditation. And I can only tell you that I get an awful lot out of that. And I recommend. And the Big Book has a very good section showing you how to meditate using the prayer of St. Francis. So it's not something exotic, but I can tell you, you know how us alcoholics are. Our mind is just like a squirrel cage. It just runs and runs and runs. And my meditation practice has helped me stop that squirrel cage for at least an hour a day. But, you know, during these 40 years, life has gone on. My parents are both passed away. I had to move four or five times, and each time I had to move, it was just a crisis. You know, you pick a family of five up and move them across the country, and then 3 or 4 years later, and no, I was not in the military. It was just all work-oriented, but a lot of things have happened to me. I can't even tell you how many people in Alcoholics Anonymous have died. Not only people that have stayed sober, but people that have not stayed sober. I don't go to funerals anymore for people that die drunk because they're just too sad. And there's never very many people there. But boy, when you get to go to a life lived, it's a joyous occasion. And, you know, we all have to learn that life goes on, things happen. Nobody exempted me from life because I'm an alcoholic. But what you all have given me, and I've gone back, I never could figure out, I had a great life. I was captain of my football team. I was an Eagle Scout. I had a girlfriend. You know, I was active in the church. Everything in my life was good. Why did I have to escape it all the time? All I know is that first time I drank, and that first time that liquor hit my stomach, it was like a relaxation bomb. There's a show on Netflix now called Euphoria. And I looked up the word euphoria, and euphoria is what we chase. We chase that feeling of just ease and comfort. Buster calls it ease and comfort, and that is how it feels. So I have 3 adult children and 5 grandchildren. The joke is, if I'd known how much fun grandchildren were, we would have had them first. But it's actually the fact that you can just spoil them to death and not have to worry about the consequences. But matter of fact, all 3 of the Virginia Beach grandchildren have COVID right now, so we're staying away from them. But Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a life that I don't have to escape from. I can get up every day and be happy. And you know, I'm surrounded by people. I tell people all the time, you're either sunshine or you're rain. And I surround myself with people that are sunshine. And you know what? If you're an old timer with a frown on your face, I don't want what you have. And I don't mind telling you. One of the freedoms of Alcoholics Anonymous is I have the freedom to choose my friends. And you know, people ask me, what's the ratio of certain type of people in Alcoholics Anonymous? And I say, well, it's the exact same ratio as outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the things I learned is this is a room full of human beings. And some of you are going to live up to my expectations and some of you aren't. It's my fault for even having those expectations, not yours. And a lot of times when I'm struggling with a sponsee, it's because they're still trying to change somebody. Happiness comes from accepting people just the way they are. And we were talking coming down here today, one of the concepts that I've learned about the higher power is the higher power does not want me to do anything to make him love me more. The higher power loves each and every one of us as much as we can be loved. So there's nothing you can do to make God love you anymore. And there's so many people that go through life trying to do things perfectly. And at one of the retreats, a guy named Bill Green, who's at the big meeting in the sky now, he came up and said, you know, Steve, if you would give up perfectionism, your life, you would be a lot happier. And he gave me a book by Ernest Kurtz called The Spirituality of Imperfection. And that the point of that book is that God created human beings in an imperfect basis, and that he doesn't expect perfection from us. But it's learning from these imperfections that we call character defects and shortcomings. It's by working with these that we grow and develop into better people. And he doesn't want us to be perfect. He just wants us to try. You know, I had a sign in my office for a long time that said winners are people that get up one more time than they get knocked down. And Alcoholics Anonymous is full of those people. They're my heroes. And so I'm so thankful that I look at what we've gone through the last couple years. And Alcoholics Anonymous is as strong, if not stronger. You know, there are good Zoom meetings around. You know, we found ways to stay in touch with each other. You know, we have the highest number of newly recovering alcoholics in Smithfield that we've ever had. And you know, you look around at the new people, and that tells you whether your group or your meeting is healthy or not. If you're attracting new people and you're keeping new people and they're staying sober, then by golly, you're doing something right. But if nobody's told you today, I love each and every one of you. Thanks a lot.
Squirt.